content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today, from the archives of the New Yorker magazine, I will read an article about Amelia Earhart and an interview of the singer Linda Ronstadt, who is now living with Parkinson's. And now, from the September 7th, 2009 edition of the New Yorker magazine, Amelia Earhart's Last Flight. The aviation pioneer was many things before and after her career as a pilot was cut short when her plane disappeared into the Pacific. By Judith Thurman. For my 10th birthday, I got the present of my dreams, a piece of Amelia Earhart luggage. It was a small overnight case made of aluminum with rounded corners and covered in blue vinyl. Between the latches was a little plaque with an ersatz feminine signature. Earhart's actual signature was loopy and uneven, with a runic-looking A. I had nowhere to go, so I kept the case under my bed and filled it with doll's clothes, a use, I suspect, of which Earhart would have disapproved. Play that prepared a young girl for domesticity was anathema to her ideals. When she lectured at colleges, as she did frequently, to promote careers for women, especially in aviation, she urged the co-eds to focus on majors dominated by men, like engineering, and to postpone marriage until they had got a degree. On Earhart's own wedding day in 1931, the 33-year-old bride handed her 43-year-old groom, George Palmer Putnam, a remarkable letter which read, "You must know again my reluctance to marry, my feeling that I shatter thereby chances in work which means so much to me. In our life together, I shall not hold you to any medieval code of faithfulness to me, nor shall I consider myself bound to you similarly. I may have to keep some place where I can go to be myself now and then, for I cannot guarantee to endure at all the confinements of even an attractive cage." The place where Earhart went to be herself was the cockpit of a plane, and that may have been the place where she died. On July 2, 1937, she became the world's most famous missing person when her twin-engined Lockheed Electra disappeared in the vicinity of Howland Island, a speck in the Pacific about midway between Australia and Hawaii, where the Department of the Interior had built her a landing strip. She and her navigator, Fred Noonan, were attempting to circumnavigate the equator, a feat for the record books, although pilots before them, all male, had rounded the globe at least six times by shorter routes, and commercial Trans-Pacific Air Service had recently been inaugurated. Critics accused Earhart posthumously of embarking on a capricious joyride that ultimately cost taxpayers millions of dollars, the estimated tab for a huge rescue mission authorized by President Roosevelt, Earhart's fan and friend. Even some of her staunchest admirers disapproved of the last flight. Earhart's biographer, Susan Butler, quotes one of them, Captain Hilton Raley, who had helped to launch her career. She was, he wrote, caught up in the hero racket. Earhart, however, was a heroic figure to millions of her contemporaries, and she still counts as one. She achieved fame dramatically in 1928 as the first woman to cross the Atlantic in a plane, the Friendship, albeit only as a passenger. Raley had recruited her on behalf of Mrs. Frederick E. Guest, known also as Mamie Phipps, a steel heiress and sportswoman who was underwriting the expedition. She had planned to play the starring role herself, until her husband, a former British cabinet minister, expressed his alarm. Three women flyers, including a princess, had already recently perished in crashes. Raley was commissioned to find a substitute, and Guest stipulated that ideally she should be an aviator, But more important, the right sort of girl. The wrong sort of girl was her rival in the race to Europe, Mabel Bull, a flamboyant former actress who was known as the Queen of Diamonds. As Guest later put it to her daughter, it just wouldn't do. Wilmer, Bill Stoltz, the pilot of the Friendship, who had defected from the Bull party, and Lewis Slim Gordon, the mechanic, had done the actual flying, and Earhart tried to remind a besotted press and ecstatic crowd hailing her as Lady Lindy that she had really been just a sack of potatoes. In 1932, however, she legitimatized the title by flying the Atlantic on her own, becoming the first woman and the second person, 5 years after Charles Lindbergh, to do so. Congress awarded her honorary major wings that she wore with her pearls. In 1935, she was the first pilot to solo across the Pacific from Honolulu to Oakland and to solo nonstop from Los Angeles to Mexico. Earhart also made or broke a slew of other records, and few Americans would not have recognized her in the street. Her image was managed aggressively by Putnam, of the publishing house G.P. Putnam's Sons, and one of the first Uber agents. He specialized in celebrity true-life adventure stories, and he had signed up Lindbergh to chronicle his flight to Paris for the Times, which paid him $60,000, and then turned the articles into a book that sold some 600,000 copies. Even before Putnam met Earhart, he had caught wind of the Guest Project and his next bestseller. By the time the Friendship took off, he had a $10,000 deal for Earhart's firsthand story and a file of publicity shots that played up her resemblance to Lindbergh. They were both lean, fair Midwesterners with winning smiles. Her legend, to a large degree, was Putnam's creation. He brokered her lecture tours, book contracts, columns, product endorsements, and media exposure. And he was so proprietary that a rival of Earhart's described him as her Svengali. She, however, was the real mesmerist. Amelia Earhart, image and icon, a handsomely designed album of their teamwork as self-promoters, portraits, press clipping, ads, and illustrations, was published 2 years ago with the notes and commentary by the editors Kristen Lubbin and Aaron Barnhart and essays by Butler and Susan Ware. Ware regards Earhart's prose of Lindbergian diffidence with critical amusements. She quotes the great aviator Eleanor Smith, who was still flying in 2001 at 89. Amelia was about as shy as Muhammad Ali. The abuse of the term icon incites iconoclasm, or ought to. Earhart was saint-like only as a martyr to her own ambition, who became an object of veneration and is periodically resurrected, her unvarnished glamour, like a holy man's body, still miraculously fresh. Embraced by feminists, she was featured on a 1976 cover of Ms. Magazine, which promised a story better than the myth. Read closely, however, Earhart's life is, in part, the story of a charismatic dilettante who lectured college girls about ambition, yet never bothered to earn a degree. In the 1990s, Apple and The Gap both featured her in ad campaigns. The Gap to sell khaki trousers, Apple to promote its corporate image of nonconformity. The slogan that appeared with a gauzy, doe-eyed photograph of Earhart in a white helmet was, "Think different." She thought of herself not only as different, but as a special case to whom most ground rules didn't apply. Three Hollywood movies, starring Rosalind Russell, Diane Keaton, and Amy Adams, have told a version of her story, and a new one, Amelia, directed by Mira Nair, with Hilary Swank in the title role and Richard Gere as Putnam, will open in October. The script is based on two biographies, The Sound of Wings by Mary Lovell and Butler's definitive East to the Dawn, published in 1997, and on Amelia Earhart, The Mystery Solved, published in 1999, by Elgin M. Long, a veteran pilot, and his wife, Marie K. Long. There were, in fact, other famous female aces in the early decades of aviation. All of them were daring. Some were said to be better pilots than Earhart, and many of them were killed and forgotten. If Earhart became an icon, it was in part because women who aspired to excel in any sphere at a high altitude looked upon her as their champion. But it was also because the unburied come back to haunt us. Earhart had already tried to circle the globe once in 1937, flying westward from Oakland, but she had crashed taking off in Honolulu. Determined to try again, she coaxed additional funds from her sponsors and more or less mortgaged the future, she wrote. The plane, hyped as a flying laboratory, it wasn't clear what she planned to test beyond her own mettle and earning power, was shipped back to California for repairs, and once Putnam had renegotiated the necessary landing clearances and technical support, she and Noonan set off again on June 1st, this time flying eastward. Weather patterns had changed. A month and more than 22,000 miles later, they had reached New Guinea, the jumping-off place for the longest and most dangerous lap of the journey. The Electra's fuel tanks could keep them aloft for, at most, 24 hours, so they had almost no margin of error in pinpointing Howland, about 2,500 miles away. Noonan was using a combination of celestial navigation and dead reckoning. They had a radio, but its range was limited. Early on July 2nd, on a slightly overcast morning, about 18 hours into the flight, Earhart told radio men on the Itasca, a Coast Guard cutter stationed off Howland, to help guide her down, that she was flying at 1,000 feet and should soon be on them, but that her fuel was low. Although the Itasca had been broadcasting its position so that Noonan could take his bearings and, if necessary, correct the course, they apparently couldn't receive the transmissions, nor apparently could they see the billows of black smoke that the cutter was pumping out. Earhart's last message was logged at 8:43 a.m. No authenticated trace of the Electra or its crew has ever been found. After 25 years of research, the Longs concluded that a tragic sequence of events, human error, faulty equipment, miscommunication, doomed her flight from the beginning, and that Earhart and Noonan were forced to ditch in shark-infested waters close to Howland, where the plane sank or broke up. There is, however, an alternative scenario, a chapter from Robinson Crusoe. It is supported with methodical, if controversial, research by Rick Gillespie, the author of Finding Amelia, published in 2006. Gillespie is a former airline crash investigator who is notably unimpressed with his subject. He describes Earhart as an average pilot and has little interest in her life or achievements. He has distanced himself from the kooks and the conspiracy theorists who have suggested at different times that Earhart was on a hushed-up mission to spy on the Japanese who interned her, that she became Tokyo Rose, or that she returned secretly to America and lived out her days as a housewife in New Jersey. In 1988, he launched the Earhart Project, which is devoted to solving what he calls the Holy Grail of aviation mysteries. Gillespie recently announced that next May he will lead his ninth expedition to the Pacific island where he believes that Earhart landed and for a while survived as a castaway. Nikumaroro, formerly Gardner Island, is an atoll about 400 miles southeast of Howland. At low tide, it is surrounded by a broad, flat apron of coral where a plane could safely touch down. The interior is covered with dense tropical vegetation bordering a lagoon. In 1929, a steamer went aground on the reef, and when its crew was rescued, it left behind a cache of provisions. The atoll was deserted until 1938, when it became one of the last outposts of the British Empire to be colonized, and was settled by the natives of the Gilbert Islands. In 1940, a colonial administrator and his work party found a liqueur bottle and some corks, a human skull, and some bones, the partial sole of a woman's shoe, parts of a man's shoes, and a sextant box. Noonan had a mariner sextant on board. A year later, the skull and bones were examined by a British doctor on Fiji. The relics subsequently vanished, but when the doctor's notes came to light in the 1990s, they were reviewed by forensic anthropologists. Their verdict, according to Gillespie, is that they probably belonged to a female, about 5'7", Earhart was an inch taller, of Northern European origin. Gillespie's case is circumstantial. Butler and the Longs are among the informed skeptics who take issue with it. But it rests on more than a second-hand analysis of missing body parts, unexplained distress calls from the mid-Pacific on Earhart's frequency, which have long been discounted as freak receptions, or as the work of a hoaxer, signs of recent habitation, seen from the air on July 9, 1937, by a Navy pilot who was searching the area but saw no one alive. Artifacts made by the islanders from scavenged material consistent with the Electra, the last line of position that Earhart radioed to the Itasca, which leads straight from Howland to Nikumaroro, but only a DNA sample can lay Earhart's ghost to rest. That, Gillespie hopes, is what the underbrush and the sands will yield. Had Earhart returned, she would have celebrated her 40th birthday on July 24th. Only a few intimates, however, knew her true age. She began shaving a year off at 22 when she enrolled in an extension program at Columbia University to take pre-med classes, and she later shaved off another. Her birthday was evidently on her mind in Miami, where the Electra was getting a final tune-up from mechanics at Pan Am, and she spoke with an old friend, Carl Allen, the aviation correspondent for the Herald Tribune. He told her frankly, Butler writes, that he judged her chances of success at 50-50. And she didn't argue, noting that she was worried for Noonan's sake, but not for her own. As far as I know, I've only got one obsession, a small and probably typically feminine horror of growing old. So I won't feel completely cheated if I fail to come back. Allen, who had covered her career from its outset, might have reminded her of another obsession, to keep proving her singularity. The typically feminine bit of vanity about her age was atypical of a woman who, from childhood, had refused to let her sex either limit or define her. Even in her late 30s, Earhart looked like an adolescent boy who had chopped off his own hair. She was lanky and nonchalant, with no hips or breasts, no visible womanliness to speak of. One learns from Butler that she flew wearing men's underpants. They were apparently superior to a woman's for the purposes of a quick pee. For public appearances, at White House dinners, in a ticker tape parade, on the lecture circuit, her wardrobe was unfrilly but elegant. And for a while she designed and modeled her own fashion label, an undistinguished line of tailored dresses and soft two-piece ensembles. But in her flight gear, a jumpsuit or jodhpurs, flat lace-up knee boots, a white shirt and a man's tie, a bomber jacket or a leather coat, she seems, at least by the codes of this century, flagrantly androgynous. Butler doesn't raise the question of Earhart's possible bisexuality, and one has to wonder if she put it to any of her sources. She does, however, make a point of noting that two conspicuously viral men donated their boxers, in one case and their briefs in another, to Earhart's wardrobe, her husband and her lover. The lover was undoubtedly Eugene Vidal, an Olympic athlete, West Point football captain, flyer, airline executive, frequent house guest of the Putnam, and largely, thanks to Earhart's friendship with Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, the director of a new agency, the Bureau of Air Commerce. Butler bases her certainty of the affair on suggestions of it in the diary of Amelia's secretary, and on speculation voiced by Vidal's widow, Catherine, and by Gore Vidal, the son of his first marriage. When the Bureau was recognized in 1936 and Vidal was fired, Earhart wrote a breathtakingly cheeky letter to Eleanor, withdrawing a promise to campaign for FDR's re-election unless her protege was reinstated. The president was said to have guffawed at Earhart's nerve. But a day later, Vidal's job was saved. As far as one knows, Earhart's secret erotic life was heterosexual. Gender, however, is a bell curve. And on that curve, she is an episeme, at least in the grammatical sense of the word, that of a noun that has one form to denote either sex, doctor or friend, as opposed to heroine or aviatrix. Unlike the cross-dressing sexual rebels of the Belle epoch, whose intention was to be outrageous, Earhart, whose intention was to stay aloft both as a pilot and as a celebrity, projected a confusing mixture of traits with such an aura of virtue and assurance that she disarmed received ideas about femininity, even of those of conservatives. Christian Lubbin quotes one of their paeans, published in 1928, which deplores the decadence of a generation slipping by stages from sly gin-guzzling to a calculated harlotry. Earhart, the writer declares, is the antidote to those shameless flappers. Hers is the healthy curiosity of the clean mind and the strong body. She will become a symbol of new womanhood. Yet Putnam, the press, and no doubt Earhart herself, were aware that there was something troubling about her appearance that had to be neutralized. Her photo spreads, Lubbin writes, were often laid out like a book of paper dolls, in which pictures of the cavalier in trousers and leather were juxtaposed with pictures of a well-bred lady in a long skirt, a fur wrap, a girlish midi, or an evening gown, her arms full of flowers. Putnam's Barnum-esque title for Earhart's first book, published in 1928, was 20 Hours, 40 Minutes, Our Flight in the Friendship, The American Girl, First Across the Atlantic by Air, Tells Her Story. Earhart was a girl of 31, passing for 29, but no one can argue with your purity as a product of America. On her mother's side, she descended from the Puritans and from Quaker ship owners who arrived with William Penn. One of her paternal ancestors, Johann Earhart, survived the winter at Valley Forge. Both branches of the family tree produced pioneers. Their boldness in facing the unknown was part of Amelia's heritage, but so was a patrician confidence of her place in the world. Amelia was born in 1897 in a Gothic mansion on a bluff overlooking the Missouri River in Atchison, Kansas. Her mother, Amy, was the daughter of Alfred Otis, a wealthy lawyer, and of Millie Harris, who had grown up in Philadelphia society and never quite overcame her nostalgia for it. Amy defied her father to marry Edwin Earhart, the son of a destitute Lutheran minister who had worked his way through law school but settled for a lazy practice at what one in law called a claims chaser. Otis brought the couple a house in Kansas City and helped with their expenses. Yet the Earharts, he a dreamer who tinkered with inventions, became a drunk. She a child of privilege, both incurable spendthrifts, still ran out of money. In later life, Amelia, like her grandfather, and with some of the same contempt, supported her mother. Accompanying the remittance checks, Susan Ware observes, were peremptory letters full of scolding and condescension that betrayed an imperious streak that was well hidden from the world. Amelia's sister, Muriel, was born in 1900, and that year Amy sent her older daughter, a precociously self-sufficient toddler, to live with the Otises in Atchison. That, apparently, is where she learned to finesse the conflicting demands of her own nature for risk and freedom and those in convention and propriety embodied in an anxious grandmother. In 1908, Edwin took a job in Des Moines as a claims agent for the Rock Island Railroad. For the next 8 years, the Earharts moved from city to city in the Midwest as Edwin's drinking inexorably destroyed his prospects. There are two kinds of stones, Earhart wrote of her life with her father, one of which rolls. They sometimes lived in unheated rooms, kept a boarding house, or camped with relatives. After years of litigation with her brother, Amy finally extracted her share of the Otis patrimony and sent Amelia at 19 to a ritzy boarding school in Philadelphia. Many of her classmates were content to be finished, but Amelia kept a scrapbook of clippings about self-starting women, a fire lookout, a police commissioner, an engineer. Her plans after graduation were to attend Bryn Mawr, but they changed abruptly on a Christmas holiday in Toronto, where she and Amy were visiting Muriel. The city was filled with wounded soldiers. Amelia dropped out of school, enrolled in a nursing course, and volunteered at a military hospital. When Canada was hit by the Spanish flu pandemic in June of 1918, Amelia caught pneumonia from her patients, and her lungs were never quite cured. In her time off, Amelia visited a military airfield. "They were terribly young, those young airmen, young and eager," she wrote in 20 hours, 40 minutes. Aviation inevitably attracted the romanticists. Whether or not she saw herself as one of them, she would come to do so. She called herself a hobo of the air and described her early flights as vagabonding. In the meantime, she gave up the idea of a career in medicine after a year at Columbia and joined her parents in Los Angeles in a spacious house on West 4th Street, which, as usual, they couldn't afford. Out of filial duty, or perhaps, as she put it, as a sunkest victim of inertia, Amelia lived with them for the next 3 years. The holy terrors in the annals of fiction and biography, spunky tomboys who, when forced into a dress, hike it up and climb a tree, have often been their father's daughters. Edwin encouraged Amelia's exploits, and a sense of the complicity as two profligate Rolling Stones stirs beneath the cliches of her prose. He had often given her the kinds of present that a man buys his son, a baseball bat, a football, a .22 caliber rifle, which she wanted for shooting rats, a letter that Amelia left for Edwin in the event of her death before the friendship flight, reads like the stoic farewell of a manly boy soldier to his sire. "Hooray for the last great adventure. I wish I had won, but it was worthwhile anyway. You know that. I have no faith we'll ever meet again, but I wish we might." The dry valleys of Southern California were a cradle of aviation, and it was Edwin who took his daughter to her first air meet south of Los Angeles and arranged for her visit trial hop in a plane. Thoroughly smitten, Amelia was ready at any price to take lessons, and after only a few hours in the air, she decided to buy her first plane, an experimental Kenner Airster. Amy gave her the $2,000 for it, and Amelia made some gestures to defray her expenses. But she quit one job after another, as a clerk at the phone company, as an amateur photographer, and with a partner in the construction business hauling gravel. Her spare time was devoted to flying, and in 1923, having learned to stunt, she was a featured performer in an air rodeo. Among the admirers of her bravado was the Earhart's new boarder. They had lost a chunk of Amy's inheritance in a disastrous mining venture promoted by Amelia. Sam Chapman, an engineer from Marblehead, Massachusetts, was 5 years Amelia's senior. They played tennis and discussed philosophy, Butler writes, and he shared her progressive ideals, including, apparently, her notions of equality between a husband and a wife. Before he left California in 1924, he asked her to marry him, and she accepted. That year was a watershed for the family. The Earhart's marriage finally foundered. Amelia's lung trouble recurred, and she sold her plane. But rather than use the proceeds to pay her hospital bill, she blithely bought a roadster nicknamed the Yellow Peril. Back in New York, she re-enrolled at Columbia, but early in 1925, she dropped out yet again and moved in with Amy and Muriel, who were living outside Boston. She took a math course at Harvard Summer School and then applied unsuccessfully for a scholarship to MIT. Next, she found a job teaching English as a second language and worked at a psychiatric hospital where, according to Butler, she lasted only a few months before deciding to leave. At that juncture, Typically aimless, though atypically depressed, she heard of a vague vocational guidance service, the first of its kind, that was run by and for women. In filling out the application, she lied extensively about her experience and credentials. In 1928, when Putnam and Rayleigh were prospecting for the right sort of girl to replace Mrs. Guest, Rayleigh called an acquaintance in the Boston chapter of the National Aeronautic Association, Rear Admiral Reginald Belknap. He told Rayleigh about a young social worker who flies. She was, he added, a thoroughly fine person. Called Denison House and asked for Amelia Earhart. Denison was a settlement house in the south end of Boston where Earhart ran night school classes in English and supervised the nursery and the activities for girls. 2 years before Rayleigh's call changed her life, an employment counselor had sent Earhart for an interview. Denison's director, Marion Perkins, was intrigued, she wrote, by the applicant's quiet sense of humor, the frank, direct look in her gray eyes, and took a chance on her. So, it would seem, did everyone. It's hard to know whether or how long Earhart would have stayed in social work if Rayleigh hadn't offered her a shot at glory. She could, for a while, throw herself into a high-minded endeavor, but she lacked the discipline to see it through. She dallied with Chapman for 6 years, breaking their engagement when she became famous. He never married. She warned Putnam that she was incapable of fidelity and that she apparently made good on her threat. Her flights were feats of courage and endurance, but compared with the achievements of the women in her scrapbook, their significance was ephemeral. Her unique experience might have yielded a memoir that would still be read, yet she published only 3 slight books, one of them posthumous, which were rushed out for commercial reasons in weeks. When people ask Earhart why she flew, she liked to say, "For the fun of it." And the fun of it was the title of her second book. Gravity was uncongenial to her, and she made light even of grave things. There was ether in the very sound of her name. Physically, too, she seemed like an airy spirit, aerial, impatient to be set free. The Earhart property that, to a layman, seems to have the greatest cinematic potential was not one that Mira Nair did or perhaps could acquire. I Was Amelia Earhart, a best-selling novel by Jane Mendelsohn, was published in 1996. It is a desert island romance based, in part, on an article by Gillespie, and Mendelsohn imagines that Earhart and Noonan have landed on an atoll like Nikumaroro. Amelia builds a lean-to by the lagoon, and Noonan constructs a shack with a veranda that looks out to the sea. In the early days of the ordeal, they bicker and mourn, but solitude and need draw them together. They fish, forage, and survive by their wits. He plays his harmonica and talks to the birds, stoned on a narcotic root. She decorates her hut with the parts from the Electra. The past recedes. Then one night, Noonan seduces her. Their wild, unencumbered sex leads to a state of oneness more precious than love. And when he spots a search plane, they hide on the jungle floor because they know now that there is no difference between being rescued and being captured. The torrid prose and the fantasy of surrender are almost a parody of the genre, and Amelia, of all people, knew that there were no idols, especially between men and women. Yet the ending rings true. It is one that she herself tried to write. She abandons everything and flies away. And now, from the September 1st, 2019 edition of The New Yorker, Linda Ronstadt has found another voice, the singer on Living with Parkinson's, The Perils of Stardom, and Mourning What the Border Has Become, by Michael Shulman. It's been 10 years since Linda Ronstadt, one of the most highly paid women in rock and roll, sang her last concert. In 2013, the world found out why. Parkinson's disease had rendered her unable to sing. ending a musical career that had left an indelible mark on the classic rock era and that had earned her 10 Grammy Awards. Ronstadt's earth-shaking voice and spunky stage presence jolted her to fame in the late 60s, and her renditions of Different Drum with her early group The Stone Ponies, You're No Good from her breakthrough album Heart Like a Wheel, Blue Bayou, and Desperado helped define the California folk rock sound. Along the way, two of her backup musicians left to form the Eagles. But Ronstadt, now 73, didn't rest on her greatest hits, experimenting instead with a dizzying range of genres. In the 80s, she starred in Gilbert and Sullivan's The Pirates of Penzance on Broadway, recorded a standards album with the veteran arranger Nelson Riddle, and released Canciones de mi Padre, a collection of traditional Mexican songs, which became the best-selling non-English language album in American history. The record also returned Ronstadt to her roots. Her grandfather was a Mexican bandleader, and her father had serenaded her mother with Mexican folk songs in a beautiful baritone. She grew up in Tucson, Arizona, close to the border, a place that has since become a political flashpoint. A new documentary, Linda Ronstadt, The Sound of My Voice, directed by Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman, and opening September 6th, looks back on Ronstadt's adventurous career. She spoke with The New Yorker twice by phone from her home in San Francisco. Our conversations have been edited and condensed. What is your day-to-day life like these days? Well, I lie down a lot because I'm disabled. I do a lot of reading, but I'm starting to have trouble with my eyes, so that's kind of a problem. It's called getting old. Well, what are you reading now? I'm reading Thomas Mann, The Magic Mountain. I somehow got to be this age without having read Thomas Mann, and I'm trying to make up for it. I read Buddenbrooks, and I fell in love with his writing. His books are nice and long, so it takes a couple of days to get through them. Who do you spend most of your time with? My son lives here. My daughter comes over. I have really nice friends. They come over and hang out with me. It's hard for me to get out. It's hard for me to sit in a restaurant or sit up in a chair. It's hard for me to stand around. So if there's a situation where I'm liable to be caught in a doorway talking to somebody for 5 minutes, I tend to avoid that. What kind of music do you listen to? I love opera. It's so terrible. I listen to it on YouTube. I'm an audiophile, but I've just gotten used to the convenience of being able to hear 29 different performances of one role. I listen to other music, too. I found this Korean band that I thought was sort of interesting on Tiny Desk Concerts, the NPR series. They get musicians to come in and play live in a really tiny little space behind a desk. It's no showbiz, just music. They have great stuff. They had Randy Newman, Natalia Lafourcade, who's a Mexican artist that I love particularly. Whatever's new, the Korean band I saw was called Sing Sing. Is it like K-pop? No, it's based on Korean traditional singing. It was kind of like David Bowie bass and drums and then this really wild South Korean traditional singing. It's polytonal. It's a different scale than we use, with more notes in it and a lot of gender crossing. It looked like I was seeing the future. In the documentary, you say, I can sing in my mind, but I can't do it physically. That sounds either comforting or excruciating. Well, it's a little frustrating when my family comes over from Arizona, because we would all sing together. That way, we don't have to talk about politics. It makes for harmonious, I don't mean the pun, relations, but I can't do that anymore. So I just invite the ones who are Democrats. How do you cope with the frustration of not being able to do everything you want to do? I've just accepted it. There's absolutely nothing I can do. I have a form of Parkinsonism that doesn't respond to standard Parkinson's meds. So there's no treatment for what I have. It's called PSP, Progressive Supranuclear Palsy. I just have to stay home a lot. The main attraction in San Francisco is the opera and the symphony, and I make an effort and go out. But I can only do it a few times a year. It makes me sick that I'm ever not in my seat when Michael Tilson Thomas raises his baton, because he's such a good conductor, and I miss hearing orchestral music. My friends come over and play music, and that's where I like it best anyway, in the living room. You broke onto the scene with such a powerhouse voice. What did it feel like singing with that voice? Well, I was trying to figure out how to sing and trying to be heard over the electric instruments. I had no idea that I sang as loud as I did. I always thought I wasn't singing loud enough because in the early days there were no monitors. You couldn't hear yourself. Why did you decide to move to San Francisco from Tucson? My children were coming home repeating homophobic remarks they heard at school. And they'd also heard other things like, if you don't go to church, you're going to hell. I thought, you know, I don't need that. So I moved back to San Francisco. I wanted them to have a sense of what a community was like where you could walk to school, walk to the market, more of an urban village experience. In Tucson, I was driving in the car for 45 minutes to get them to school and then 45 minutes to get them back in a hot car. I didn't want that life for them. I can tell that you have a real sense of mourning over what the border used to be. Well, people don't realize that there's Mexican, there's American, and then there's Mexican-American. They're three different cultures, and they all influence each other. And they all influence our culture profoundly. The cowboy suit that Roy Rogers would wear, with the yoke shirt and the pearl buttons and the bell-bottom frontier pants and the cowboy hat, those are all Mexican. We imported it. We eat burritos and tacos, and our music is influenced a lot by Mexican music. It goes back and forth across the border. So what drew you to folk rock in the 60s? I loved popular folk music like Peter, Paul, and Mary. I loved the real traditional stuff like the Carter Family. I loved Bob Dylan, and I tried to copy what I could. When I heard the Byrds doing folk rock, I thought that was what I wanted to do. How did your recording of Different Drum with the Stone Ponies in 1967 come about? It was a song I found on Greenbrier Boys' record, and I thought it was a strong piece of material. I just liked the song. We worked it up as a kind of shuffle. It wasn't very good with the guys playing guitar and mandolin, but the record company recognized that the song was strong, too. So they had me come back and record it with their musicians and their arrangement. And I was pretty shocked. I didn't know how to sing it with that arrangement, but it turned out to be a hit. In your book, you talk about being with Janis Joplin and trying to figure out what to wear on stage. Oh, I could never figure out what to wear. I grew up wearing Levi's and a t-shirt or a sweater and cowboy boots or sneakers. And that's what I left home with. And that's what I wound up with. In the summer, we'd cut the legs off the Levi's and they were Levi's shorts. When I got my Cub Scout outfit, that was a real change for me. You say that you and Janis Joplin couldn't figure out how to fit in. You didn't know whether to be earth mothers or whatever. We didn't know whether we were supposed to cook and sew and embroider. Roles were being redefined. There were a lot of Earth Mama hippie girls who knew how to do that stuff. There's a clip in the documentary of you being interviewed in 1977, and you talk about how rock and roll stars became alienated and are surrounded by managers who are willing to indulge them, and that's how people wind up with drug problems. Well, they get involved with drugs because they felt isolated. Stardom is isolating. There are a whole bunch of people that you're hanging out with who are trying to become musicians. And some were chosen and some were not, and it becomes a difficult relationship with the people who weren't chosen. Sometimes they're resentful. Sometimes you feel uncomfortable. It's like Emmylou Harris has in a song, "Pieces of the sky were falling in your neighbor's yard, but not on you." The adulation made people feel disconnected. I also think that some people's brain chemistry is more vulnerable to addiction. I was lucky. Mine was not. There's been a lot of looking back this year, the summer of 1969, with those big anniversaries of the moon landing and Woodstock and the Manson murders. What do you remember about that summer? Well, when Woodstock happened, I was in New York. I remember getting all the reports from people like Henry Diltz and Crosby, Stills, and Nash. They'd come back with stories of everybody being in the mud. It sounded like a good thing to have survived, but I'm glad I didn't go up there. Overflowing toilets and no food is not my idea of a fun time. I was playing some club, probably the Bitter End. When the Manson family came through, they managed to murder my next-door neighbor, Gary Hinman. I was lucky I wasn't home that night. They may have come for me. We knew those girls, Linda Kasabian and maybe Leslie Van Houten, too. I lived in Topanga Canyon at the time. And they would hitchhike, and they would talk about this guy Charlie at the Spahn Ranch. I didn't know him personally. We knew it was kind of a bad scene. But when we found out how bad of a scene it was, we were horrified. People must have been really scared before they were captured. Oh, everybody was freaked out. We weren't sure at the time whether the Gary Hinman murder was connected to the other murders, but we found out soon enough. In going through your history, I've noticed you've been selectively outspoken. There's an interview from 1983 where a talk show host in Australia asks you about deciding to perform in South Africa under apartheid, and you give this speech about how if you didn't play anywhere with racism, you wouldn't be able to play in the American South or Boston. You also take shots at Ronald Reagan and Rupert Murdoch. As a popular performer, was there a cost to speaking out? I never talked on stage for about 15 years. But there were certain causes that we as a musical community united against, and one of them was nuclear power. We did a lot of No Nukes concerts. James Taylor, me, Jackson Brown, Bonnie Raitt. And if it was a particular cause that I was in favor of, I did what I could do to help. But I don't think my focus was particularly political. If somebody asked, I was perfectly happy to give my opinion. In the documentary, your former manager, Peter Asher, says that you would see people whispering at your concerts and imagine that they were saying, "She's the worst singer I've ever heard." Were you really that insecure? I just didn't feel like I could sing quite well enough. It was best when I forgot about everything and just thought about the music. But it took me a long time to get there. I didn't want to see people that I knew in the audience. I didn't like to see the audience. Actually, I couldn't understand why they'd come. It's a different relationship than singers like Taylor Swift have. I think it's a little bit healthier that they embrace their audience and sort of feel like everybody's on the same team. We were encouraged in the 60s to think of us and them. The hippies started the whole tribal thing, and it was the straights against the hippies. It was unhealthy. How did you overcome your self-doubt? I just say, breathe and sing. As long as I pulled my focus back to the music, I was fine. Your relationship with Jerry Brown is covered in the documentary and in your book, but not your relationships with some other prominent people like Jim Carrey and George Lucas. Is there a reason for that? I was writing about the music. They didn't have anything to do with my musical process. Well, what did Jerry Brown contribute to your musical process? Well, he was there when Joe Papp, the founder of the Public Theater and Shakespeare in the Park, called saying that they wanted me for HMS Pinafore. But Jerry gave me the message wrong. It was actually the Pirates of Penzance, which I didn't know. Do you keep in touch with him? Yeah, we're friends. We've always been friends. He came over last Christmas. What do you talk about? Water in California. He said when he retires, he wants to study trees and California Indians. I gave him my tree book, The Hidden Life of Trees. There's a new history of water use in California that's fantastic. It's called Dreamt Land. It's like John McPhee level writing. It's really worth it for the writing alone. I have to admit, I was born in the 80s, and I discovered you through The Muppet Show. What can you tell me about working with Kermit? Oh, I had a crush on Kermit, so it was a problem because of Miss Piggy. He was her property, but we really had a good time on that show. There's something extraordinarily creative about puppeteers. They're fascinating because when they do all their acting, they can't let it go through their own body. I think they're just loaded with talent, I loved watching them. It was a very cooperative experience. They let me help them with the story and the songs. Because you're a singer but not a songwriter, so much of your artistic expression comes through your choice of material. How did you choose songs for Heart Like a Wheel, including the title song by Anna and Kate McGarrigle? Well, I was just ambushed by that song. I was riding with Jerry Jeff Walker in a cab, and he said, I was at the Philadelphia Folk Festival, and I heard these two girls singing. They were singers. They sang a really good song. You should hear it. And he sang me the first verse. Some say the heart is just like a wheel. When you bend it, you can't mend it. But my love for you is like a sinking ship, and my heart is on that ship out in mid-ocean. And I just thought they were the most beautiful lyrics I'd ever heard. I said, you have to send me that song. And I get this tape in the mail, reel to reel, with just piano and a cello and the two girls singing their beautiful harmony. The manager I had at the time said it was too corny. Somebody said it would never be a hit. And I don't think it was ever a radio single. But it was a huge song for me. I sang it all the way through my career. What were the biggest challenges of becoming a public figure? Not having the ability to observe other people, because people are observing you. I had to keep my head down all the time. It was kind of excruciating. I still feel that way. I don't like to be on the spot. Also, relationships were hard, because I was always on the bus. In an interview from 1977, you said, I think men have generally treated me badly, and the idea of a war between the sexes is very real in our culture. In the media, women are built up with sex as a weapon, and men are threatened by it as much as they are drawn to it, and they retaliate as hard as they can. Do you remember what you were talking about? No, I don't. I have to say that when I look at my whole career overall, what counted the most was whether you showed up and played the music. I saw it happen with Emmylou. And I saw it happen with Joni Mitchell. Joni Mitchell was threatening to everybody. She could play better. She could sing better. She looked better. She could just do it all. But it's true. There was a certain amount of chauvinism. There weren't a lot of girls in the business who were doing what I was doing, so my friendship with Emmylou Harris became so important. Did you find that there were things that were harder for you as a woman than for your male contemporaries? Well, I had to do makeup and hair. And that's a lot because that's 2 hours of the day you could spend reading a book or learning a language or practicing guitar. Guys just shower and put on any old clothes. And then there were high heels. I have extra ankle bones in each foot, and high heels were agonizing. I used to wear them on stage, kick them off, hide my feet behind the monitors, and find my shoes again before I had to leave the stage. At the height of your rock and roll fame, you decided to do Gilbert and Sullivan. What drew you to that? My sister, when she was 11 and I was 6, I guess, sang HMS Pinafore in her junior high school. My mother had a book of Gilbert and Sullivan operettas on piano, and somehow I learned the songs. I heard my sister practicing them, so when I heard Pirates of Penzance, I knew what Gilbert and Sullivan was. Was part of you tired of being a rock star? Part of me was very tired of it. I was singing loud in halls that didn't sound like they were built for music. I liked the idea of a proscenium stage. I think a proscenium has a lot to do with focusing your attention. A theater is a machine built to focus your attention and allow you to dream. You're hypnotized in a way, and the person on stage is your champion, is telling your story. You find emotions you didn't realize you had. Throughout the 80s, you experimented wildly with genre, everything from Puccini to the Great American Songbook to Mexican canciones. I'm sure your record label was surprised when you said, I want to make an album of Mexican folk music. Well, before that, I wanted to do American standard songs, and they said, no, it won't work. In fact, Joe Smith, the chairman of Elektra Asylum Records, even came to my house to beg me not to do it. He said, you're throwing your career away. I've been away so long working on Broadway. Were you worried that your fans wouldn't go along with the standards either? I didn't worry about it until after we made the record and we were opening at Radio City Music Hall. And I realized all of a sudden people might not show up. They really might hate it. I was ordering matzo ball soup from the Carnegie Deli next door, and it gave me the shake so bad I could barely stand when I got on stage. I was holding hands with Nelson Riddle in the wings. He was nervous, too. He said, "Don't let me down, baby." And I said, "I'll do my best." He was the best of those arrangers. Worked with the Rosemary Clooney and Frank Sinatra and Ella Fitzgerald. He wrote beautiful charts for me. I was really lucky to have him. I went back to my apartment that night and just smiled because we had gotten away with an evening of American Standard songs. When I see something now like Lady Gaga recording a Standards album with Tony Bennett, it seems like she owes you a debt. Well, she owes me nothing. She's got enough talent to make it on her own. But up until then, attempts by female pop artists to go back and do Standards had not been successful. And Joan Baez had tried to record in Spanish, and that didn't work. It depends on what the audience is expecting of you. When I did Mexican songs, I brought in a whole new audience. I played the same venues, but it was grandmothers and grandchildren. People brought their kids. And the Standards audience was older. They were in their 50s and 60s, which seemed impossibly old to me at that time. You also collaborated with Emmylou Harris and Dolly Parton. Do you keep in touch with them? Emmy comes out to Hardly Strictly Bluegrass, which is a bluegrass festival here in San Francisco, so I see her about once a year. She comes over to my house, and we used to sing together. Now she brings her laundry, and we talk. When you're on the road, you always have extra laundry. If you could wave a magic wand and record one more album, what would be on it? It would be an electric mix. There's a song called I Still Have That Other Girl written by Elvis Costello and Burt Bacharach that I always wanted to record. And there's a Mexican song called Paloma Negra I always wanted to record. I'd record all those songs that I didn't get around to. Well, we've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.